Imagine spending $2 million on a massive technology upgrade.
Yeah, that is a huge check to write.
Right. I mean, the board approved it, the vendor promised that it would completely revolutionize your workflow, and it was supposed to be, the ultimate fix for your operational bottlenecks.
The silver bullet.
Exactly. But then
Yeah.
let's say 6 months post-launch, you walk the floor and you realize half your staff is secretly reverting back to manual Excel spreadsheets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because the new software is just too complicated.
And that right there is the gritty reality of what happens when a software implementation goes off the rails.
Yeah.
It's not just a technical failure, you know? It's a failure of alignment, of adoption, and fundamentally, it's a failure to understand how the business actually operates beneath the surface.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are tearing down why these massive tech projects fail, and more importantly, how you can stop that from happening to your organization.
Definitely.
We are zeroing in on a major headache for leadership teams today, which is navigating co-managed software projects.
Right, which is so prevalent right now.
It really is. So our mission today is to equip you, the leader listening to this right now, with a highly practical framework. And this is specifically tailored to the intense 2026 business climate we're seeing in Orange County and Southern California.
A very unique climate.
Very much so. We are going to give you the tools to evaluate risks, vet your vendors, assess your own internal readiness, and map out a bulletproof 90-day success plan.
To set the baseline here, when we talk about a co-managed software project, we are talking about scenarios where your internal team has to work side by side with an external vendor.
Just to keep a critical system running, right?
Exactly. And usually a company only finds themselves in this arrangement because they are feeling acute pain.
They didn't just wake up and decide to do this for fun.
No, not at all. They are dealing with a spike in operational risk, or they have systemic documentation failures where, institutional knowledge is literally walking out the door.
Oh, yeah.
Or they are stuck in a vendor relationship built on blind trust rather than repeatable, verifiable processes.
And before we can actually fix a broken project, we really need to talk about the environment forcing these decisions in the first place.
That's crucial.
Because buying enterprise tech in 2026 is a fundamentally different sport than it was even, say, 5 years ago.
Oh, completely.
Especially in highly competitive regions like Southern California.
The leverage has shifted entirely.
Yeah.
Budgets are significantly tighter now.
Right. The money isn't just flowing like it used to.
Exactly. Borrowing costs dictate that your capital expenditures must show immediate ROI. And the baseline expectations for cybersecurity are just vastly higher.
You can't just wing it anymore.
No, you can no longer afford to sign a multi-year contract based on a charismatic sales pitch. Leaders are now required to demand hard, irrefutable evidence before they hand over the keys to their infrastructure.
Which brings us to the absolute first mandate if you are staring down a new project. You have to define the outcome first.
Yes. Rule number one.
Before you look at a single software interface, you have to identify the specific business process that needs improving or the risk that must be mitigated.
Or the exact customer experience that has to change.
Right. And critically, you need the specific metric that proves progress.
Because skipping that step is where the entire foundation cracks.
Yeah.
If you don't define the outcome and map out the existing systems, data flows, and employee handoffs that influence that outcome, you fall into a huge trap.
The tool-first trap.
Exactly. You let the tool dictate your business process rather than the other way around.
I see this happen constantly. Falling into that tool-first decision, it's like buying a massive industrial snowplow just because it was on a 50% off sale, even though you live in Orange County.
That is a great way to put it.
Right. Like a snowplow is an incredible feat of engineering. But if your actual problem is a congested commute on the 405 freeway, applying the wrong tool to your specific environment is entirely useless.
No matter how good the discount was.
Exactly.
What's fascinating here is how the mechanism of an outcome-first approach forces a reality check.
Yes.
It completely strips away the vendor's marketing fluff.
It cuts right through it.
It does. When you lead the conversation with a rigid business outcome, you force the vendor to speak in terms of reality, not features. It changes the dynamic from, "Look at these amazing dashboards," to, "Show me the evidence."
Yes. What evidence supports the recommendation, right?
Exactly. Show me how this specific integration solves our inventory delay.
Okay, so a leader takes that advice, they define their outcome, they map their environment, they know what they want. How do they actually go about evaluating the vendors promising the moon?
Without getting dragged into a 6-month procurement swamp,
Yes, exactly.
you deploy an evidence-based scorecard. And to evaluate a co-managed project effectively, that scorecard has to evaluate multiple dimensions simultaneously.
Can't just be about price.
No, we're looking at capability, yes, but also security architecture, implementation quality, communication protocols, documentation standards.
There's a lot there.
Reporting, scalability, cost transparency, and exit readiness.
Let's slow down and dissect a couple of those because it's easy to just, you know, list criteria on a clipboard.
Sure.
Let's take implementation quality. I mean, every vendor on earth is going to claim their implementation is seamless. How do you actually score that objectively?
By demanding the artifacts of their past work, redacted if necessary.
Oh, wow. So you don't just take their word for it?
Never. You don't ask, will the rollout be smooth? You say, provide the workflow diagrams, the detailed migration steps, and the service level expectations you used for a similarly sized client in our industry.
And if they push back?
If a vendor stumbles or says that they usually just figure that out during phase one, that is a glaring red flag.
Good to know.
You are looking for a highly defined scope, clear access controls, and a concrete rollback plan if the launch fails.
I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, though.
Go for it.
If I'm a leader dealing with a failing legacy system, my board is breathing down my neck to modernize yesterday, demanding workflow diagrams and rollback plans before I even approve the statement of work. Doesn't that just guarantee we move at a snail's pace?
I hear that frustration from executives all the time. But this is the classic trap of enterprise tech. Leaders conflate the lowest initial time estimate with the lowest total cost.
Ah, I see.
Approving a vague scope quickly feels like progress, but it almost guarantees catastrophic delays during implementation.
Because you run into things you didn't plan for.
Exactly. You will inevitably crash into system dependencies you never mapped out.
So you essentially buy a fast pass to a brick wall.
Exactly that. And one of the most powerful strategies to cut through a vendor's aggressive timeline is to ask them inverse questions during the vetting process.
Inverse questions? Like what?
Instead of asking what they will do for you, ask them what they would actively avoid doing in your environment. Ask them what specific operational scenarios would cause them to halt the project entirely.
Oh, I like that. You are forcing them to admit what could go wrong, testing if they actually understand your specific risk profile.
The strongest partners will not hesitate to answer that. They will actively volunteer the trade-offs.
Right. They aren't afraid of the reality.
They're the ones who will look at your compressed timeline and say, if we hit this deadline, we have to narrow the scope of phase one. Otherwise, we introduce unacceptable data risks.
That builds so much trust.
It does. A vendor who promises a flawless, rapid deployment without acknowledging the operational friction is a vendor who hasn't thought deeply about your reality.
But even if a vendor perfectly passes that rigorous scorecard, they are still an outsider, right?
True.
They can build a flawless technical system, but if your internal team rejects it, the project still fails. So how do you structure your own team on the inside to actually catch the baton?
The internal architecture of a project is where most co-managed efforts silently die.
Really?
Yes. To survive, you must assign 4 non-negotiable, highly visible roles within your own company.
Okay, let's hear them.
You need an executive sponsor, a business owner, a technical owner, and an operational reviewer.
Let's dig into the friction between those roles. Because if you just list them out, it sounds like standard corporate bureaucracy.
It can sell that way, yes.
But how do these 4 actually interact when things go wrong? Let's say the vendor hits a snag and needs to delay the launch by 3 weeks to rewrite some code. Who makes the call?
That scenario is exactly why you need all 4. The technical owner is the one who audits the vendor's claim to verify if the bug is legitimate or just an excuse.
Okay, makes sense.
Then the business owner evaluates if a 3-week delay ruins the quarterly revenue goal. The executive sponsor handles the political fallout and signs off on any budget overages.
And the 4th one, the operational reviewer.
That is often the most critical role. It's the reality check.
Mm.
They are the one who says, if we deploy the workaround the vendor is suggesting, it adds 15 clicks to my team's daily workflow, and they will absolutely refuse to use the system.
Wow, that dynamic is fascinating. Having those distinct, conflicting priorities represented is crucial.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, without this visible ownership, even a brilliant recommendation loses momentum right after the first meeting.
It makes total sense. Because if you just throw the project at a generalized committee, you fall victim to the bystander effect.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like a group assignment in high school where everyone assumes someone else is writing the conclusion and you show up on presentation day with half a project. If everyone owns the implementation, no one owns the implementation.
Exactly. And tied directly to that internal discipline is a requirement that almost every organization treats as an afterthought.
Let me guess. Documentation.
You got it. Rigorous documentation. We are talking decision logs, architecture diagrams, access control lists, and change histories.
Which people usually treat as a chore to be handled by an intern at the very end of the project.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
Wow.
Do not treat documentation as an administrative chore. You have to treat it as the black box on an airplane.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
You don't care about it while the flight is smooth, but the second the project crashes, it is the only thing that tells you exactly whose fault it was and how to recover.
It's your insurance policy.
It protects your company when your lead engineer suddenly quits, when a server fails, or when a completely new team takes over 3 years from now and needs to understand why a bizarre configuration was approved.
So it's basically proof that you know what you're doing.
Thorough documentation is the loudest signal that a team, both internally and externally, possesses actual operational discipline.
Okay, so let's fast forward a bit. We have the outcome defined. The vendor survived the inverse questioning. The internal team is locked into their roles, and we are documenting everything.
Sounds like a solid start.
But how do you actually push this into the company without bringing daily operations to a screeching halt?
You rely on a highly rigid, phased implementation roadmap. You never execute a cutover all at once.
Never do it all in one weekend.
Never. The progression starts with deep discovery, moves into a baseline technical audit, establishes a priority ranking for features, and then requires a localized pilot or proof of concept.
You test it small first.
Right. Only after the pilot succeeds do you move to full implementation, followed by user training, active monitoring, and a post-launch review.
And to prevent that roadmap from devolving into an open-ended money pit where the vendor just keeps billing hours month after month, you have to constrain it.
Yes, very strictly.
This brings us to the 90-day success plan. Why exactly 90 days?
Because 90 days is the perfect psychological and financial constraint. It's long enough to execute meaningful work, but short enough to hold a vendor accountable before the budget spirals.
Okay.
The structure is essentially a 30-30-30 breakdown.
Walk us through that pacing.
So the first 30 days are dedicated exclusively to clarifying the current state and identifying gaps.
Why does that take 30 days?
Because frankly, employees often misrepresent or misunderstand their own workflows.
Yeah.
You have to audit the reality of the work.
They think they do step A, then B, but they actually do A, C, then B.
Exactly. Then days 31 through 60 are focused on piloting just the highest value improvement. You don't boil the ocean. You just fix the most painful bottleneck to prove the system works.
And the last 30 days?
The final 30 days are for reviewing the metrics from that pilot, documenting the friction points, and forcing a hard decision.
Like a go or no go.
Right. Do we expand this? Do we adjust it? Or do we kill it?
And during that entire 90 days, you are measuring progress against the single metric you defined way back in step one.
Exactly. It all ties back.
But I want to push back on a specific piece of conventional wisdom regarding rollouts.
Okay, let's hear it.
Often, companies will leave their old workflows and legacy systems running parallel to the new software just in case something breaks. Isn't keeping the old system running a perfectly logical safety net?
This raises an important question. It feels like a logical safety net, but in practice, it is fatal to user adoption.
Why is that?
Because human beings naturally default to the path of least resistance. If you leave the legacy system running, employees will completely bypass the steep learning curve of your expensive new platform and just go back to the interface they already know.
Ah, so you are actively enabling them to ignore the millions of dollars you just invested.
Precisely. Beyond killing adoption, running parallel systems destroys your ability to measure success.
Because the data is split.
Yes. If half your sales team is logging data in the new CRM and the other half is still using their old spreadsheets, your analytics are entirely corrupted. You cannot accurately measure efficiency gains if the adoption is fragmented.
So what's the alternative?
Once the pilot phase proves the software is stable, you have to execute a clean cutover. You burn the ships.
Burn the ships. I love that.
It's the only way. You have to be asking, how will success be measured after 30, 60, and 90 days? If old systems are running, you can't answer that.
Let's turn to the existential threats that hover over literally every tech initiative right now. Even with a perfect 90-day rollout, two massive risks remain: security vulnerabilities and vendor lock-in.
Oh, the big two. security can no longer be outsourced to the IT department at the very end of a project.
It has to be baked in.
Every single technology choice carries an inherent security dimension. You have to map how access is granted, how data is encrypted in transit, and how security incidents will be escalated between your team and the vendor.
And what fascinates me is that this level of paranoia applies even if you were just buying a marketing tool.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of leaders hear cybersecurity and their minds immediately go to banking infrastructure or HR payroll systems. But a modern marketing suite holds massive customer databases.
It holds API keys to your social channels, deep administrative privileges.
Exactly. If a vendor mismanages a marketing integration, it can trigger a catastrophic data breach just as easily as a compromised server.
Every new integration expands your attack surface, period. And that concept of protecting your leverage ties directly into the second threat you mentioned, which is vendor lock-in.
Right. I always explain vendor lock-in like signing a lease on a massive commercial building.
Okay, how so?
You need to know exactly what the financial penalty for breaking the lease is, and you need to physically walk the fire exits before you move all your heavy machinery inside.
That is spot on.
Because once your operations are running inside their walls, your leverage drops to zero.
That is a perfect framework. To maintain your leverage, you have to engineer your exit strategy before the project even kicks off.
Before you sign the contract.
Yes. You must secure raw data export capabilities, establish who legally owns custom code or configurations, and demand a written transition protocol in the initial contract. Do not wait until a vendor relationship turns toxic to ask them how you are allowed to leave.
And orchestrating all of this, the outcome definitions, the scorecard vetting, the internal roles, the security architecture, the exit strategy, it's incredibly complex for an internal team to handle while also running their day jobs.
It is often too much for an internal team.
Which is where organizations often bring in a consulting partner to architect the deal before any software is purchased. And for leaders specifically in Southern California, specialized firms like Technasian act as that pre-decision consultant.
Right. They operate as the neutral architect. Whether an Orange County business is looking at a massive infrastructure migration, a managed service overhaul, or even targeted security improvements for Microsoft 365, a specialized consultant helps validate the requirements against reality.
They map it all out.
They translate your operational bottlenecks into the phased governance roadmap we've been discussing, ensuring both the vendor and the internal team know exactly what happens first.
And who owns it.
Exactly. And for leaders who want to study the broader mechanics of software delivery and project governance on their own, tapping into global frameworks from organizations like PMI or Atlassian provides excellent foundational knowledge.
Those are great resources.
A trustworthy recommendation always connects business impact, security, cost, and ongoing support. It's never just a one-time task.
So synthesizing everything we've unpacked today, what is the final mandate for the leader listening to this? If we strip it down to the studs, you have to intentionally slow down your decision-making process.
Absolutely.
Resist the urge to buy the discounted snowplow just to show momentum. Define the rigid business outcome first. Force vendors to provide workflow evidence, not marketing promises.
Architect your internal team so that specific people own specific risks.
Yes, and constrain the entire rollout within a ruthless 90-day evaluation plan.
And treat your documentation with the respect of a flight recorder.
We have covered the mechanics of how internal teams and vendors need to interact to survive these massive transitions. But as we wrap up, where should a leader's focus go next?
Well, I want you to turn the mirror around for a moment.
Okay.
Throughout this deep dive, we've focused heavily on frameworks to ruthlessly evaluate a vendor's capability and discipline. But consider the inverse. If an elite top-tier vendor were to evaluate your company's internal documentation and decision-making processes today, what would they find?
Oh, wow.
Would they see a cohesive, disciplined organization? Before you demand perfection from an external partner, ask yourself the hard question, is your internal house actually ready to be a good partner in a co-managed project?
That is a deeply uncomfortable but entirely necessary question to carry into your next board meeting. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Remember, when it comes to enterprise technology, there are no magic bullets, only rigorous, uncompromising execution. We'll catch you next time.